to episode 6 of Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm the editor of Tech Central. I'm here with Candace Jones, the deputy. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Duncan.
So, lots to get to this week. Tech for Africa, I think, has been the big news over the last couple of days. This big conference organized by Gareth Knight. And I think before we even get kicked off with the show, well done to Gareth for organizing a fantastic 2 days.
Must admit, it's been very, very slick. The media facilities have been fantastic, and the speakers are just impeccable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've organized much smaller events for Tech Central in the past, and organizing something of this scale, I think there must be 1,000 people there over the last 2 or 3 days. Organizing something of this scale is really, really complex and difficult to do. So all credit to Gareth for getting top international speakers and top local speakers as well to present.
Absolutely. One of the top local speakers that I saw was Steve Song. He had a great presentation there.
Yeah. In fact, let's chat a little bit about that, Candace. I unfortunately missed Steve's presentation because I was preparing for a panel discussion of my own at the conference. But tell us a bit about what Steve Song was talking about. There's something to do with potatoes.
Yes, indeed. Sounds strange, but it's true. And Steve reckons that these potatoes will bring communications to small rural villages in Africa. What he's actually talking about is the mesh potato. It's an open source project, a hardware project, where himself and a couple of other guys have got together and hacked some wireless kit to link together in a mini telephone network in a small area. But a really impressive little piece of technology.
It's basically just it's a Wi-Fi router that kind of talks to other Wi-Fi routers and creates this mesh network where allowing people to communicate over small distances.
Yes. It's not a national telephone network. You can't pick up any number or dial out any number directly. But it's to really connect villagers together using a Wi-Fi mesh environment that allows them to pick up the phone and say, how's it to the next door neighbor or the guy down the road?
We actually talk about this we were talking about this last night while we were recording Talk Central's sister podcast, the ZA Tech Show. And if you don't know the show, check it out at zatech.co.za. But we were actually wondering what happened to that one laptop per child project that Nicholas Negroponte from MIT introduced several years ago. There was huge fanfare. It was on the cover of Wired magazine. It was talked about everywhere, and I haven't actually heard anything about it recently. Candace, have you?
No, I haven't. But another one of the speakers at the Tech for Africa conference this week, Laila, she spoke about trying to get technology into rural Africa, rural India, to do an outsourcing project that she's involved in. And she tried to use the one laptop, but it was not powerful enough for her needs. So, perhaps that's what's happened is that cheaper tech is now available and they're more powerful.
So this mesh potato product that Steve Song and the Shuttleworth Foundation are backing, how much does it cost?
Well, it's a sub $100 device. Obviously, that's still in prototype. When the scale picks up, it will probably be more around $52 to $80 per device.
Okay. Okay, but this is just a router. It's not a computer that you can actually type on and...
No, but there are access points, and you can VoIP out to a national network. So it is a pretty powerful device, but it's not intended for broadband use. It's primarily intended for basic communications.
Okay, interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see how they do. I know that you mentioned the $50 to $80 target range. I know that one of the problems that Nicholas Negroponte had with the one laptop per child project, which I think has been renamed to something else. I've forgotten the name of them for the moment, but his challenge was always trying to get it down to $100, and I don't think he ever really achieved that. It was around the $250 and then the $200 and then the $180 sort of level, but never got it right down.
I think scale is a big issue. When you don't have the basics like a telephone line or a basic internet connection, selling these devices becomes very difficult. And you don't get the scale that you need to manufacture something to the price point that you need. So, Steve Song has done it the right way. He's really looking at a hacked old piece of hardware and has made a deal with a Chinese company that is a win-win for both. So they're basically getting it at a really decent cost.
Great, great. Well, remaining on, talking about infrastructure, this panel that I hosted at Tech for Africa this week was really interesting. We had Peter Ace, the group CEO of Vodacom, as well as several other top telecoms industry executives, Angela Gahagan, who is the head of MTN business, Stafford Marcy, who's wearing various caps, but in this case was talking on behalf of CECOM, and Dave Smith from Infraco, and I'm missing one person.
Jeff Fletcher,
that's right, from 365 Network Solutions. Interesting discussion about the infrastructure challenges, particularly in the national backhaul and in the last mile here in South Africa. We've got all this capacity coming down to our shores in terms of CECOM, WAX, all these undersea cables. Now, the real challenge is figuring out how to get that connectivity to end users. Now, really, one interesting project, and perhaps slightly controversial project because it's been run by government, is the Broadband InfraCo project, started by the former Public Enterprises Minister, Alec Irwin. Now, this business, Candace, is about to launch, right?
Well, according to Dave Smith, the current CEO of InfraCo, yes, in the next couple of weeks we should expect to see a commercial service from the company, which is quite a surprise since they've been quiet for a very, very long time.
Yeah,
maybe slogging away trying to find out where they belong in industry.
Yeah, finally getting around to launch a service. I know there was all that controversy last year about whether they should get a service license in addition to their network license. I think that in the end they didn't succeed in getting that service license because there were fears that InfraCo could come and compete with some of the retail operators. But apparently they've got 12,000 kilometers of fiber in the ground now. I think a lot of that they actually bought when they were created from entities like Transnet and Eskom. But they've got 12,000 kilometers of fiber in the ground to link, aimed primarily at linking the big cities together. And they're creating points of presence in the main centers. I think they've put in a pop, at least here in Johannesburg, at the InfraCo data center facility in Isando, east of Johannesburg, and are also looking at creating other points of presence around the country, I think 6 to 8 of them initially. So while I'm always a big fan of free enterprise and free market competition, I suppose, you know, even with government involved here, it's going to be a good thing because it will help to bring down broadband prices, as long as this company doesn't, start to undercut its commercial rivals at a loss and damage the market in that way. I think that they probably can bring some benefit to the market in the short term.
I do think that they do have a bit of a problem though, with wholesale, because they're playing primarily in the wholesale space. The wholesale market has become really competitive and prices are plummeting. You know, CECOM came in, Telkom has dropped rates, and you look at the internal infrastructure that's coming in over the next couple of years, MTN, Vodacom, a whole bunch of other companies that are putting in fiber that are running national fiber links and metro fiber rings. The internal infrastructure in the wholesale market is going to be competitive. What InfraCo faces now is how does it stay sustainable while still bringing everything that it needs to the underserviced areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the point Dave Smith made in the panel discussion was that infrastructure, the cost of bandwidth on national backhaul, and I may be getting this figure wrong, but if I recall him correctly, he said that national backhaul, and he didn't use Telkom's name, but he was making it quite clear that Telkom's cut national backhaul prices by 60% in the last 12 months.
It is at 60% of what it was 12 months ago.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. So prices are falling. Let's hope they continue to do so. I think that the other presentation, and I must emphasize that while we're doing this podcast, Tech for Africa is still ongoing, so there's probably more that's going to be coming out during the course of this afternoon. But the other interesting presentation, and Candace, you were in there this afternoon, was by the presentation by Clay Shirky. I'm not quite sure how to describe Clay. He's a social media expert or a author, what did you take out of his presentation?
Well, there was lots that he was speaking about, and some discussion that we had after the discussion with other of the delegates was that a lot of it wasn't actually new, but a very interesting presentation nonetheless. Looking at how people are consuming media and what the internet has done to change the way people consume media, giving them the power, obviously, to share and to engage, which is nothing new. But what was very interesting was that he was talking about how they engage on the basis of culture and trying to create a product, an online product or a media product, that doesn't engage on the cultural side, can often have dire consequences. And a lot of you can see a lot of the successful internet businesses have come through culture and through the development of small sharing within a community that share the same culture, and then just it eventually gains critical mass. Facebook, Twitter, all of these really popular applications are really coming from that basis, and I think that was very interesting. And a lot of things that really struck me is engaging with those people online, giving them a platform to engage with you on a cultural level, I think is very important, and something that a lot of online publications and online media specialists need to think about.
I was really intrigued by what he was saying about sort of the next big thing and trying to see where the next big thing is going to come from, and kind of took out from what he was saying. I mean, you talked about the development of Linux and how it's basically just started as an idea of a guy who wanted to develop an operating system for fun to run on his PC, and he never even knew if it would run on anything other than his own personal computer, and how that developed into an operating system that took on the giants like Microsoft. Wikipedia, the suggestion that the first articles on Wikipedia, the guy didn't know where this was going and what was going to happen. He was just experimenting and playing around, and no one saw this coming as the next big thing. So I almost took away from this that it's impossible to predict what the next big thing is really going to be, because half the time it just seems to happen by accident.
Well, like he says, when the internet started, no one knew what would happen and how it would happen. So, next 10 years, possibly the same thing. But what really struck me about the Wikipedia discussion was he says that all in all, Wikipedia has taken around 100 million hours of effort communally to put together, which is about...
It sounds like a lot, but it's not really, is it?
No, not at all. Considering the amount of TV just in the US that's watched amounts to about 1 trillion hours a year, which makes Wikipedia's actual development time minuscule.
Yes, in fact, I think the quote figure he used was more television adverts are watched on average in the US every weekend than all the time that has ever gone into Wikipedia articles, which is quite amazing. Anyway, let's move on, Candice. The other big story, which was exclusive to us this week on Tech Central, that was followed up on some of the other news outlets, was the news that Andile Ntaba is looking to potentially invest in a national backhaul fiber network. I guess this would be a bit of a competitor to Dave Smith's InfraCo project. And of course, Andile is, as you know, is a former shareholder in Telkom by virtue of the Elephant Consortium, very controversial Elephant Consortium deal that was done a couple of years ago. Now, his shareholding in that, he sold out. His interests in Telkom were held through his company Convergence Partners, and they sold out Telkom a couple of months ago. It's very hard to calculate how much money Andile made out of this sale, but I think it's reasonable to speculate that he did fairly well out of his period at Telkom, especially from the huge number of dividends that were and generous dividends that were paid by Telkom over the years. Obviously, Convergence had to settle debts. There were debts in the structure which had to be settled, so that makes it difficult to calculate how much money is now sitting there post the sale. But one assumes that he's looking now at potentially using some of that money in partnership with other companies to roll out new infrastructure. Now, Candice, as you know, Andile, through Convergence, is already, a 15% shareholder in the Seacom undersea cable system.
Yes.
So the opportunity he clearly sees here, I would guess, I haven't spoken to him, is to take that undersea capacity and start to bring it into the cities.
Well, that's the missing last mile, isn't it? It's what we need now, is the capacity to the consumer.
Absolutely. Bringing that capacity into the cities and then down to the ISPs, and then eventually, I guess, or maybe that's going to be Andile's project in 5 years, is building fiber out to people's houses. But for the moment, it looks like he's trying to. And I must emphasize that the discussions he has held, I understand, are very much preliminary. I believe that there have been some discussions with Internet Solutions. In fact, Internet Solutions has confirmed that there have been some just talks between the parties. And it's also speculated that Cell C may be interested in forming a partnership or coalition with Convergence Partners to do this project. And as you know, Lars Reichelt, the CEO of CellC, has indicated that the company is going to need to deploy its own fiber infrastructure to its towers over time because it can't afford, literally can't afford, the high cost of leasing that fiber from other operators like Telkom. So, interesting times in the infrastructure space, and it's long overdue, I would submit.
I agree, definitely. It's something that we've been talking about for a number of years now, I think. A lot of the other mobile operators have already shifted into high gear to get their infrastructure in, and it's good to see if it's true that CellC is getting on the bandwagon, especially with a partner like Convergence.
Great. The other big developments this week, I guess, were around some management changes and people moves. Some quite interesting developments over at MultiChoice, although not entirely unexpected. Nolo Lutele, the long-serving CEO of the MultiChoice South Africa, was due to retire later this year, and in fact, the company has now announced that he's going to be appointed as the chairman of the MultiChoice South Africa group, and will be replaced by Imtiaz Patel, who is currently the CEO of SuperSport. So some interesting management changes there. And the other interesting news, the very well-known and quite colourful, if you've ever met him, you'll immediately recognise him by his strong Australian accent, Justin Spratt from Internet Solutions, who's been at Internet Solutions for the last 6 years and has been involved in a number of important projects for the company, is moving on. He's leaving to join Rob Stokes and the Quirk team, the digital marketing agency. I think that's an interesting move, and all the best of luck to Justin in that new role.
Yeah, it will be a big blow to IS, though. He did do a lot of interesting work there. I understand he was integral in the hotspot rollout, and did a lot of work on the mobile front. So
yeah, he started the IS Labs business, and he, in fact, his last project there was the mobile voice business, where he's been involved in developing applications for cell phones to allow cheaper calls over mobile handsets using voice over IP. Quite an interesting project, and I think maybe caused some discomfort to mention Data, because Data works with the big mobile operators are clients of Dimension Data's, and I think Justin went around and said, we're going to go out and slay these big evil cell phone companies. I'm not sure that went down too well at Data head office, but certainly a colourful character, and I'm very glad he's not leaving the industry. He's just moving on to a new role and a new challenge. So we'll be hearing more from Justin, I've got no doubt.
Well, wish Justin luck, and also to the Quirk team. They've got a handful coming.
Yes, indeed. I think Justin will fit very well into that Quirk culture there. It's a great company that Rob's actually built there. We must maybe do a profile on Rob and what he's done at Quirk sometime soon for our profile section on Tech Central. Candice, it's not all been good news this week. I'm afraid you've been following this news of the Home Affairs arrests and allegations of corruption involving the CEO or one of the directors at Lefarge Technology. Tell us more about that.
Indeed. The CEO one of the executives of Home Affairs has been arrested and on allegations of corruption. It's a little bit of a difficult situation, and not much is known at the moment, but the police have them in custody, and they will have a bail hearing on Monday, and there'll be more information there. But from what I understand, at least one of the characters that have been arrested from Home Affairs was something of a smoking gun for a very long time within the Home Affairs department.
When you say smoking gun, you mean troublesome or?
Yes, it apparently has been problematic and has been under suspicion before. So it's a very dire state of affairs, but it was handled well by the Home Affairs Minister, who tasked her DG to get straight on it, and the DG had a press conference detailing exactly what's happened and why they've been arrested in terms of corruption. Allegedly, the CEO tried to pay $200,000 directly to Home Affairs to have a contract extended of some nature. But little is known, and we're still digging, so we'll come back to that next week.
Now, Home Affairs recently cancelled this huge contract that they'd awarded to Kajima AST, or now known simply as Kajima Group. Is this related in any way to that?
From what I understand, no. The actual contract that that was involved in this has not been revealed, but the Who Am I Online project, which was the project awarded to Gajima, is apparently not involved in this at all. This from one of my sources and a person close to Home Affairs. But there are other issues around the Who Am I project, which are quite interesting. But from what I understand, the Lefachi CEO was once a contractor to the Home Affairs Department before, not too long ago, before he was appointed CEO of Lefachi.
It all sort of turns in on itself here, doesn't it? Because the CETA, which is the state's IT agency, the state's IT buying body, basically, was involved in awarding this contract to Lefachi originally, right?
Yes, there are allegations that CETA is involved in corruption as well. However, the Hawks are having a little bit of a problem creating those links because they're awaiting a report that was completed, I think, 2 years ago now on CETA that's sitting with the DPSA minister, the Department of Public Services and Enterprises, and that has not yet been handed over to the Hawks, and they're waiting on that before they can make any move on questioning CETA and investigating.
The reason I'm asking, and I'm not drawing any inferences by asking this question, is the former CEO or acting CEO, there seems to be acting rather than permanent CEOs of CETA, Nadine, I think her name is Nadine Mapumba Isaacs.
Isaacs Mapumo, she was also CEO of Lefachi.
She was CEO of Lefachi, so there's also some intrigue here, which...
Well, if you look at the history of the Department of Home Affairs, Mavuso Masimang went from CETA to Home Affairs, or vice versa, and Nadine also, and it looks like Coltrane, the CEO, the now arrested CEO of Lefachi as well.
Interesting. Anyway, Candice, we'll be back right after this ad break.
Welcome aboard Voxair Teleconferencing, where you can enjoy first-class service at a fraction of the cost, without the wait or the jet lag. Just an automated, hassle-free way to connect with people wherever they are, and all the legroom you need. It's like being there without the hassle of getting there. So why travel for business when you can simply teleconference? Call 01-0001-0001 or visit voxair.co.za. Voxair Teleconferencing from Vox.
Welcome back to Talk Central. Candice, you've been doing quite a bit of rereading, in fact, quite a long document this week that ICASA put out, in fact, over the weekend on Internet Protocol Television, not to be confused with Internet-based television, and Video On Demand. ICASA seems to be grappling with the... how to regulate, or if it should even regulate, these services. Tell us more about that.
Well, Duncan, the process for ICASA actually started in February, where they put out an initial document saying that they would like to get industry perspective on whether or not IPTV or internet TV and video on demand downloadable content should be regulated. And if it should be, how should it be? And if it should be, then, you know, what are the processes that should be followed? And ICASA went to industry and did long discussions with them and has come back now with a discussion document detailing a possible decision on how to regulate these two services. It's quite complicated, and there's a lot of technical detail in the document, which is why it took me so long to get through. But essentially, what we're looking at is the difference between broadcasting technology and internet technology, because these two services fall between both, thanks to the convergence of these two technologies now, with fantastic broadband services available. So what ICASA says is, because IPTV is almost streamed TV, so that's TV that the broadcaster pushes out via a network or the internet. So the regulator is suggesting that they regulate it under the broadcast license because they're calling it linear. The other issue is of course, that it might not be, but that's another debate in itself. Video on demand, similarly, is it's a selective choice. So there's a lot of audience participation, which means it's non-linear. So
this really sounds like ICASA is looking for an excuse to regulate something that doesn't actually need regulating.
Well, that's just it. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not it should be regulated, although industry representatives have said, with with what CASA has and the law that it has, it's done as good a job as it can in this discussion document. Look, it's not regulated yet. The regulator hasn't actually, ICASA hasn't actually given any indication that it's going to. And it's still early days, but I think that they would run into a minefield if they actually start trying to do this.
Yeah, it worries me. I mean, I almost want to say to ICASA, you know, don't do what comes naturally to you, which is to regulate something just because it's not regulated. Not everything needs to be regulated. And this may be one of those areas. You know, regulation can kill something before it even takes off. So maybe we should just back off, guys, and leave this area alone for a while.
Well, that's what the broadcasters are hoping, I'm sure, because if they're regulated on these services, any Joe Schmo from the US or from the EU can pop in with their service because it's hosted somewhere else and not be regulated and take over the market.
So the broadcasters would be keen for regulation?
No, not at all.
Oh, they wanted the regulation that exists already on them to be removed.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
Who doesn't, though?
No, I mean, quite honestly, the only area where I think the regulator should be involved is in ensuring that the broadcasters aren't broadcasting content during times of the day where children might be seeing offensive content. Other than that, I should just get out of the market.
Hopefully that will be the case for these two services.
And of course, in terrestrial television, they need to manage the whole issue of scarce radio frequency spectrum. But when it comes to delivering a video service over the internet, I mean, you know,
anybody can do it.
Is ICASA, next thing you know, ICASA is going to come up and say, well, let's try and regulate YouTube.
Well, that will be interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, what should we talk about next? The Public Protector and Yonder Probe. You've been following that as well, Candice. What's the news there?
Well, we got basic results back from the Public Protector this week on two investigations into two tenders awarded to a company that has alleged links to the Communications Minister, Siphiwe Nyanda. The Public Protector has cleared Nyanda on both accounts, saying that he was not involved in awarding these tenders or made no financial benefits from these tenders. One was to the Gauteng Roads and the other was to Transnet Freight Rail Services, both to a company called General Nyanda Security Risk Advisory Services. But the Transnet issue wasn't completely clearing because Nyanda at the time of the allegations stood up for the CEO of Transnet Freight Rail, Gama, and sort of backed him up, protecting him from the media, which the Public Protector said was not in the best interests of government or the department, and gave him a bit of a slap on the wrist for that. But for the rest of it, he seems to have been cleared of all tender issues.
Well, good news for Nyanda. Let's keep an eye on the situation there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Candice, the last story I think on our list for this week, I think we must touch on, although we are running out of time, is the news that Neotel has finally launched its prepaid product many, many months after they were supposed to be launched.
It seems a little bit of an airy fairy launch. Details on how much an individual handset will cost. But you can get the cost of the basic prepaid vouchers.
Yes.
It seems...
Well, I actually spoke to the... one Dylan Zorte, who's the head of communications at Neotel, and he indicated that the only handset that you can buy at the moment is this 599 Rand device, which is not capable of a connection speed of above 150 kilometer second. So it's not broadband. It's basically being sold as a voice product. A phone call costs 50 cents a minute on network, which is expensive. And 50 cents also to Telkom. So fixed line calls are basically 50 cents, and then calls to mobiles, I think, vary between 1 rand 20 and 1 rand 50, depending on the time of the day. And then 20 cents per megabyte for data. But, you know, there's no broadband dongle or anything available at the moment. So you can't use the CDMA EVDU network. You can only use the basic CDMA network. One wonders why Neotel has taken so long to introduce so little to the market. I really do wonder whether this company's strategy is failing, especially in the consumer market. I mean, they've got less than 50,000 customers, and it's taken them this long to come up with a product that no one, frankly, is going to buy.
And that's just it. This product should have been one of the first. This possibly should have been the first consumer product, given the massive success of prepaid for the mobile operators, and yet here we are with a half-hearted effort. It does speak of a management issue or a competition failure.
I don't know what it is. Sometimes this company strikes as being far too conservative. You know, they're facing robust competition from much bigger players in the market. If you're a small player, you need to come up with something special that's going to grab the market's attention. You can't afford to come up with a sort of softly approach, come into the market with a product that doesn't have any real, that I can see, compelling sales proposition and expect it to fly. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see where this company is going in the consumer space. Maybe they should give up on the consumer space, although I'm not sure they can, given their license conditions.
Well, I don't think they ever had any intention of targeting the consumer space aggressively.
But they've spent about 600 million rand on their CDMA network, which was specifically built for the consumer market.
Well, Multilinks in Nigeria also, CDMA operators also failing.
Yeah, Neotel is far from being a Multilinks in terms of its financial position. But Candice, we were discussing this week that there are some parallels in that Multilinks is a smaller player operating with a technology which is incompatible with what the bigger players in that market are using, namely CDMA versus GSM. And here we have Neotel in South Africa, which has built a CDMA network and is facing competition from really big, powerful, incumbent GSM and UMTS operators. It may be time for a rethink in terms of strategy.
Agreed.
Good, Candice, it's half an hour show. I think that's about the limit of what we want this show to run to. So thanks again for listening. And as always, if you've got feedback on the show, please send us an email at info@techcentral.co.za. From myself and Candice, have a great week.